stupid. He comes across in front of me every single time he overtakes. Where does he want me to go off the track?
No! Stop talking to me in the braking zone.
Guaranteed to be more dramatic than Aaron Rodgers in a playoff game. Welcome to a brand new era.
Mate.
You are the world champion! I am your host, Andre Harrison, and with me, as always, for the foreseeable future now, I can gladly announce, first of all, from America, Mr. Ryan King. Hello, sir.
Hello, go pack go, or sad pack sad.
God bless motherfucker Fitz, as I like to call him, after the... after that game winner. And on the other corner, representing Dartford, Mr. Adam Johnson.
It somehow doesn't sound anywhere near as glamorous as America, no, Dartford. You're not giving me much of a chance here, man.
No, it isn't. But I guess I can now gladly announce this is going to be your permanent hosting trio going forward, ladies and gentlemen. Now, if you've been following any of the three of us over the last couple of weeks, you may have noticed some changes.
Really?
just a couple. Just a few minor tweaks here and there, like me quitting YouTube.
Yeah, this section of the podcast is the one entitled, "Since when did your Facebook page change its entire name?"
I've had that sucker for 4 years and not changed it once.
Yeah.
But I think I've got some explaining to do, basically. And yeah. I think we all have. Yeah, to this point, I've been relatively vague about most of the podcast's plans going forward. I've dropped in little hints and teasers here and there. But if you've taken the time out to listen to this part of the show, then congratulations. You're getting the full brief here first. Congratulations. You're a loyal listener. So, I bet the first question you're asking is, why did I quit YouTube? To put it briefly, it's a dead horse. It's a dead horse. No one's looking for F1 gameplay 6 months after the games come out. There's the way the community is going over there, it's clearly leaning towards four or five dudes. You can probably guess most of who those four or five dudes are. They're piggybacking off each other's success.
Are they all in a YouTuber specific Formula One championship?
Might be. apparently. But you know, the way the community was going, the way myself was going, because I've said it before, I feel like my strengths are better as a writer and as a podcaster now compared to me as a video maker. I'm not going to be the kind of guy that spends 3 hours a day editing stuff. That's just not my strength. It just isn't.
That's mine.
Yeah, that's Johnson's strength. We'll get to that, we'll get to that in a minute. But that was never my strongest asset. I always feel like as the podcast grew from what was originally a university project into something that became a proper baby of mine, something I actually really enjoyed doing, I kind of realized that I'm probably better off at this than doing the whole YouTube thing constantly. And given what I am good at, which is mostly analytical, journalistic style kind of content, why would you look for a video game for that? So, you know, it just simply put, it just didn't make any sense to keep wasting resources into something that was never going to bear any real fruition. My channel's barely grown in the last year and a half. I've gained about 500 subscribers in a year and a half. It was a dead horse. And I was never going to be able to compete with guys like Ben, like Arav, like Matty, etc. So, as a result, I thought, let's do this podcast full time. And I put this suggestion forward. Adam came down to my house just this time last week, and we talked it over. And after that conversation, and actually reading the comments on my last ever Dre Talks I did, talking about the frustration of being a middling YouTuber, I read the comments on it, and I think that's what took me over the top. And it was something that had been on my mind for about 5 or 6 months, and like the comments and then talking to Adam about it was what kind of pulled the trigger for me on the whole thing, basically. And it was my brother's birthday when I made that video to say, yeah, this is it. Time to move on. And
you make it sound like it was like a birthday present to your brother. Happy birthday, bro. I've quit YouTube just for you.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. I didn't think of it that way, but now you mention it. but yeah, so basically, we are doing this podcast full time throughout 2016 at least. And it's going to be a little bit inconsistent now because there's not an awful lot to talk about out there in the motorsports world. Obviously, it's the off season and obviously it's January. But once late February rolls around, the podcast will be coming out once a week. We've been a little bit inconsistent. In 2015, we were a bit inconsistent. Sometimes we were once a week. Sometimes we were every 2 weeks. It was just more like when I felt like it, more than anything else. So we're going to commit to once a week from late February all the way through till Christmas, more than likely, throughout the year. As you've already guessed, me and Ryan are going to be permanent co-hosts, as is Adam Johnson. You might step back as occasional times. He's also going to be producing and editing the show for us. We are taping this on January 18th, which is a Monday, and we're going to be releasing the podcast on a Friday. So if you're a particular fan of Downforce, for example, you're getting that and Bike Live all in one day. Hooray!
Dre squared.
Dre squared. Double Dre. Get the hashtags going. So that's the plan. We're going to record on a Monday, film, and then produce it for Friday. You will actually get a sneak peek of the podcast on YouTube probably Wednesday or Thursday, the day before the podcast actually comes out, if you subscribe to the YouTube channel, which doesn't actually have a custom URL yet because of Google Plus rules. You've got to have a channel for 30 days, but I'm going to try and take Motorsport 101 if it becomes available in about 3 weeks time and whatnot. So if you haven't subscribed to the YouTube channel, just search for Motorsport 101, or if you haven't already, go on my old channel at Harrison101HD. There is a new video on there explaining where the new channel is. Try and find it if you can. And the plan with the new channel is you're going to get I'd say, depends on the show, but I'd roughly aim for 3, maybe 4 video highlight segments of the podcast per episode. So you get a nice spread range of content throughout the week before getting told about a new show, which is, you know, great for everybody. And I'm still more than happy to do Dre TVs every once in a while as well to help fill the void a little bit where that's concerned. So that's the rough plan. Basically, it's not finalized. We could always change things here and there. We're very flexible when it comes to these things, but that's the rough plan. Also, we're going on Patreon with this thing. I look forward to the snooty side of the internet telling me you can't ask for money, even though Twitch blatantly exists.
And Chris Harris has made an entire car show on YouTube based off Patreon.
Exactly, because, you know, everyone and their mother has a Patreon account these days, so we might as well do the same, right? And given that YouTube is kind of a dead horse when it comes to ad revenue these days, we're going down the Patreon road as a way of guaranteed income. If we get to certain objectives, I'm sure we could expand ourselves further, maybe down the roads of live production, like live, doing shows live instead, as well as the tapings.
Our ultimate goal is to raise $50,000 to bring Ryan King to the UK.
Hey!
Yay, no more internet connection failures.
Or me and Dre to the US. Dre, do you fancy that instead?
I'm down. I'm down. Then again, a black guy in the United States probably isn't the best idea sometimes. Like, you may accidentally get shot. On the whole, yeah, that's kind of
King's
the
King's just sat over there like, damn, man, I'm the one already here.
This is also true. But that's kind of the plan. The Patreon isn't set in stone just yet. I'd say give it maybe another week or two and we'll have something finalized out for that. Mm-hmm. Because that's actually very important to actually get a decent pitch out there for what we want to do.
Of course, yeah. We don't want you guys just pinging, be like, we don't. Basically, what we don't want to sound like is like we're shaking a collection tin, or like a begging bowl. That's not what we're out about at all. It's if you feel like, you know, because we understand. I did a crowdfunder myself for Team Bomber Sports last year. You understand? Not everyone can afford to. Not everyone wants to. But if you enjoy what we do going forward, you fancy supporting it, that's the best way to do it over on our Patreon. You'll see more of that very soon.
Yep, absolutely. And I just want to make one thing absolutely clear. We are not going to withhold content from you, and we're not going to put a gun to anybody's head to say, oh, if we don't get to this level, we're not going to produce the show anymore. No, it's not like that. We're doing it because we want to do it.
YouTube
it's just
Red can go where the sun doesn't shine.
Yeah, exactly. It can go fuck itself. So basically, it's one of those situations where if you really feel like helping us out, that would be fantastic. If not, not a problem at all. It's just we feel like if we can support ourselves and make a bit of money on the side doing this, why the hell not? Absolutely. So, you know, that's pretty much the long and the short of our plans, right, Johnson? I think that just about covers everything.
There's a few other things I wanted to add, just a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, sure, go for it.
Mainly just because... Oh, hello, my microphone's working now. Hey. Just because when we had that meeting last week, what was interesting about it is, to be honest, I feel like you probably could have kept going with the gaming channel and made it really good, but it was clear that your motivation doesn't lay there anymore. It's clear that this is what you really want to do, and I'm all on the train for that, as is King, who has helped to make us some awesome new graphics, new logos and everything. That's really cool.
Yeah, he's busted stops on that one.
Yeah, because it was quite funny. As we're recording this on the Monday, I've just spent 5 days away on business in Birmingham and Milton Keynes, and I wasn't around on social media as much, but I kept checking our little group chat that we've got going, and it was just back and forth, graphics, pinged, website details, stuff happening. It was amazing. I was like, okay, I've got to get my shit together. When I come back, I've got to be ready to go. And yeah, it's really exciting in that respect. There'll be multiple ways to follow the show. Usual place will still be on harrison101.com.
Indeed, yeah.
Still be over there, yep.
That'll still be the biggest home for the site, as well as obviously the obvious iTunes outlets, yes, like iTunes.
On iTunes, yep. As for the Patreon, as I say, there's going to be no exclusive content behind that because paywalls suck, to be honest with you. But there's going to be bonus bits and bobs, Google Hangouts, things like that. Dre, I believe you've done things like Dre and Friends watch this race and stuff.
Yes.
Exclusive Dre TV, maybe. Who knows? It's all that sort of stuff. And yeah, it's all good. It's all good up until now. Basically, we're committing to make this podcast as awesome as possible, and we look forward to you guys joining us on the ride. I'm stoked to get going.
Yeah, me too. So that's pretty much the long and the short of it. If you have any other questions, please do not hesitate to get in touch with me. I will do my best to answer, because this whole thing's come about very quickly. Like, there's only been about a week in the process or so, and you know, I've had to call in so many favors to even make this happen. I feel ashamed of myself for the amount of favors I've had to call in on this one, and there's two or three more people behind this I've got to thank as well. I've got to thank Stephanie Hunter, my website manager, because she is an absolute angel, and I would not be doing this if it wasn't for her. She's been absolutely ridiculously helpful towards me helping out on this one. And a lot of the artwork you're going to see on the channel is going to come from Zara Daniela as well, so thanks to her as well. Follow her on Twitter at Zara Sahid. She is brilliant, and she's also got a very, very funny merch website called Mind Puncher Paradigm. Google it as well. It's very, very good. So thanks to her as well. She'll be doing a lot of the artwork for us as well. So there's a real team behind this, and I don't know if I'd actually end up saying this. I'm in charge of a team of people on the internet.
The Harrison 101 Empire.
God, that feels so disgusting to say. So again, and obviously before I get going, a massive thank you to everybody for all the kind words and support ever since I announced this. Was it 14 days ago? I mean, that's 2 weeks ago was when I first made this announcement, and I've been overwhelmed with the amount of messages, sincerity, you know, good wishes, thoughts, you know, support ever since the last 2 weeks. And you know, to have such a great audience is just a wonderful blessing I could ever wish. You know, I couldn't wish for a better audience. I've said this time and time again, and I will repeatedly say that because it's the goddamn truth that you guys are wonderful. And if it wasn't for the confidence you guys have in me as a person, I wouldn't be doing this. So thanks to all of you guys, and I can only hope I can deliver on what I set out to accomplish, and your belief in me won't go to waste. So, without further ado, let's get on with the rest of the show, and this is a big opening segment, one we actually missed during the whole shuffle because of the week off, well, 2 weeks off the Upstream podcast and things like that, that the BBC has cut Formula One. Their Formula One coverage, their partially live F1 coverage, has been gone as part of their big round of cutbacks. We kind of half hinted this in the last episode towards the end. We talked about how it was looking that way, but it's now finally been confirmed that Channel 4 are going to be getting the F1 coverage rights that BBC have left behind. And this is a massive deal, King, for the UK.
Yeah. Oh, God, I can't even remember when BBC got the coverage my TV, but it seems like forever ago.
2009. Yeah.
Yeah, now it seems BBC decided to get out of their contract early and give the rights to ITV.
Or so we thought it was ITV.
Yeah, everyone thought it was going to be ITV, but then it ended up going to Channel 4.
Yeah, because it turns out Channel 4 actually had a 10-point plan to take F1 forward. Around that kind of time in 2011, they had a plan to try and get the F1 rights and had a 10-point plan to be able to try and put it forward. And they actually had a plan originally going forward with this. So it's not like it's come out of nowhere and Channel 4 just rushed this team together to say, no, we're going after this, guys. No, they had a plan in place a good few years ago to try and make this happen. And now here's their opportunity to be able to do it. And it's a shame to a degree because it's, if you've been following F1 in the United Kingdom in terms of their coverage, they had pretty much everybody they could ever wish to have when BBC took the rights in 2009. It was a real dream team. They put a fresh young face in there in Jake Humphrey. They had David Coulthard and Eddie Jordan. That was such a brilliant trio of hosts and what they were able to do.
Martin Brundle on commentary.
Yeah, Martin Brundle on commentary. Jonathan Legar, but they moved him on quite quickly for Ben Edwards. They had David Croft, I think, doing the practice sessions as well before Sky poached them. And very slowly, Sky started gutting their team out when they got the live rights in 2013, I think I want to say it was.
Yeah, because the BBC, that was when they split their coverage. They went down to 10 live races and sold the rest to Sky Sports. And that really alienated a lot of fans in this country who believed that it was, like, they'd heard all the things of, in the, what was it, the Concorde Agreement and things like that it had to be on free-to-air. And the BBC went, not every race has to be on free-to-air.
They found
Sky,
a loophole.
Sky, have it, bye, cha-ching!
Yeah, they basically found a loophole. So that's the long and the short of it. They found an easy way to cut costs because F1 is an expensive sport to broadcast, and for those that are an expensive sport in general. It's a very expensive sport in general. I mean, you're flying a crew around to 19 different races around the world in the period of 8 months or so. I mean, you can... And obviously, live TV is expensive enough as it is. It's even more when you factor in you're going around the world to film in a constant tight schedule over the course of a 8-month period. That's expensive.
It is.
And for those that are unaware already, the BBC are already making big cutbacks to their sports department. Many of that is down to the lack of TV license money. And much of that is down to the inevitable hit that Top Gear is going to take later this year when that show comes back on TV, because Top Gear was a guaranteed £60 million a year in revenue. That's what that show was worth to them. And it's not going to be the same without Clarkson. So to compensate, they've had to, you know, butcher their live sports coverage to a large degree. And that's been one of the biggest hits. And
which is a real shame in that respect, because I always thought the BBC sport coverage has historically always been really good, or generally to a good standard, mainly from a production viewpoint. I think a lot of their camera angles and things, like for example their grandstand coverage in the 1990s and how they how they had their as live coverage of the British Touring Car Championship, and their historic Formula One coverage was always very good. Their presentation was great generally, although, you know, as with most sports coverage, there was a little bit of bias there, but generally it was a bit less, or they at least tried, because they were under the remit of having to be neutral. So, anyone who's watched their rugby coverage will know it's about as neutral as three Welshmen cheering a Welsh Grand Slam can be. But, I mean, that's one thing that's being cut. They're selling off half of the Six Nations to ITV. So, I mean, it's going to get to the point where that golden ring fence around Wimbledon, which is the one bit of sport they will fight tooth and nail to the very last, there'll be like bailiffs climbing the ramparts outside BBC Television Studios London, and they'll still be in the offices going, quick, protect the Wimbledon coverage! Protect the Wimbledon coverage! Anything else they can get rid of. Wimbledon, no. They will fight to the last. But I always, ever since that Sky Sports deal, I always got the feeling that it was a matter of when, not if, that the BBC would try and get out of it. And I think, as I say, it's a big surprise they're moving it to, that it's Channel 4 that are the ones picking it up, because you don't associate Channel 4 as a sporting network. They do cricket. They did the Paralympics and did a very good job with that, I have to say.
Yes.
They do horse racing. But otherwise, they're very much the sort of edgy, youth-orientated. They'll have like the kind of edgy comedies, reality shows, and the dramas and things like that. And you kind of don't associate them with a very fairly serious, expensive premium sport like Formula One, but we remain to be proven wrong on that one. It'd be very interesting. And they did start, I have to say, on the right foot with their press release saying that they had the coverage. Within the first paragraph, they made sure to say there'd be no adverts during the races.
Yeah, that's a very, very good news. And I know that was one of the biggest complaints when ITV had the coverage back in the obviously late 90s to early 2000s until 2008 when they left. They had ads all through the Grand Prix, and often you would miss key moments of action. And because they were using the world feed, they couldn't go back and show it again unless the world feed did. So, yeah, it often caused many problems. And, yeah, Johnson's absolutely right. Channel 4 has always been the edgier broadcaster on mainstream terrestrial British TV. Their own catchphrase is born risky. And that's what they do. And you're right, they're not the biggest prolific sporting broadcaster out there. They used to have the Ashes, obviously, and, you know, the horse racing is still a big deal for them. And you know, they did win awards for their Paralympic coverage, but when they did the mainstream ones in Daegu, I mentioned this before, how bad Ortis Dealey was as a host. And he had that famous blunder. He just went, "Jessica Ennis, good night." And it was just one of those really awkward things that went viral. And it didn't go down well at all. But on the whole, like, if anyone is going to put a fresh take on F1, it would be Channel 4 out of all the mainstream broadcasters. So actually, to a degree, I'm casually optimistic about what they're going to do. I'm cautious, but at the same time, there's potential for it to be great. And we've already found out that they've given the production rights to Jake Humphrey's co-owned production company, Whisper Films. They've already confirmed that. They've already confirmed that David Coulthard is going to be one of the hosts of said coverage, which is great news, because DC was a very dependable, very versatile presenter on BBC, in my opinion, at least.
I think of the pundits they had over there, I think Eddie Jordan could be guilty of a little bit too much going for the kind of shock jock angle.
Yes.
But I think Coulthard, especially when he was alongside Martin Brundle in the commentary booth, he's a very surprisingly perceptive pundit. I say surprisingly because it doesn't really fit with his actual image or what people associate with him, but I always feel like he was very fair. He would call things as he saw it. He wouldn't go too over the top. He wouldn't get too nationalistic and jingoistic as you know, as some commentators and some broadcasters can get almost out of enthusiasm. Exactly. But I always felt like him and Martin Brundle worked really, really well together. I mean, look at some of the races they called, especially that Canadian Grand Prix 2011.
Oh, God.
They had to work very hard to fill the time in that, what was it, a four-hour rain delay, and then call the finish of one of the most epic Grand Prix of modern times. I think they handled that spectacularly.
Yeah, if you ever want to see that, that is world-class sports broadcasting, to be able to time-fill so effectively for over an hour during that rain delay. It's one of the actual gem parts of why Canada 2011 is such a special race. Is not only could the race was a complete epic in its own right, basically the Michael Bay movie of Formula One races, but at the same time, it had a one-hour rain delay that wasn't boring, which is just the most amazing thing you could ever wish to see. So, yeah, if they were going to pluck one of the BBC guys to come over for Channel 4, I probably would have picked DC myself. So, yeah, on the whole, I think Channel 4 are going about it the right way. If you ever want to see the 10-point plan, quickly Google it. It's look at it from Channel 4 images. Like, it's easy to find. And there's a lot of intriguing and good stuff in there, like educational programs. They're trying to, you know, to no red button extras or anything like that. They're very to the point, and I do like the direction that they're going in. And everything I've seen so far is thumbs moving up in my direction. So, at least from my perspective, at least. So I don't think they've really done anything that's massively questionable in my regard.
No, not at all. King.
Go on, King.
Sorry.
Yeah, but how long do you guys think free-to-air coverage could last in Britain? Because back when BBC first got the rights and then sold it off to Sky, when they sold it off to Sky, Sky was looking to essentially monopolize the world's F1 TV coverage, because as of right now, they own the TV rights to F1, not only in Britain, but Germany, Italy, Latin America, all of Southeast Asia, and Australia.
Yeah, that's a good question. And the honest answer I have for you for that is, I'd say maybe 10 years at the most. And the reason why I said that is because the industry is changing. And you've told me before, King, that that live sport is like the last bastion of television
Yeah, it really
in
is.
That regard. And if Bernie ever wakes up, or maybe someone that is a production company can come out and say that, yeah, maybe we should go down the internet road with this thing, and they could put a paywall behind it. If they knew that could make money, then they would have done it by now.
And well, that's the big thing, isn't it?
I think that day is coming. I mean, we saw the WWE do it with the WWE Network a couple of years ago now, and that's actually worked out to be great. Once they've got over a million subscribers on their network now already as it is, which is, you know, a way of replacing the kind of archaic pay-per-view model they had for decades. So I don't know how long it's going to be. I'd say... I mean, when Netflix's own CEO is coming out and saying that he reckons TV will be obsolete in 15 years, as we know it, I wouldn't maybe go that far. But if there's one sport that's kind of archaic when it comes to its broadcasting, it's Formula One.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is funny when it comes to the whole thing. So that might you know, stop the bleeding for a little bit. But
the thing is about it is that the thing that's keeping free-to-air kind of hanging on in this country is that the viewing figures on free-to-air are still massively higher than on subscription channels like Sky. Like, for example, an average Sky broadcast of a Formula One race in the UK will get, what, 3 million
About 3 million,
maybe?
Yeah.
And on BBC, they used to average 9, 10, 11 million plus. Mm-hmm. So that's what's keeping it on free-to-air, the sheer availability of it, the fact that so much of the population can watch the program. And if you go to, like, for example, another series that's done this recently is V8 Supercars in Australia. They signed a deal with, I think it was Fox or Foxtel in Australia for the last year. Similar sort of thing. They had a certain amount of races on free-to-air. And the whole schedule and everything.
Wink, nudge. Foxtel is a subsidiary of News Corp, which also owns Sky.
That doesn't surprise me. This is Rupert Murdoch's evil empire. He probably owns everything in the world. I'm expecting the world to, you know, like the epic World War III, not to come down to a battle between nations, but a battle between, like, Virgin, Tesco, and News Corp. It'd be like the three corporations that take over the world, and maybe Manchester City will be the fourth one.
I mean, on the whole, you're absolutely right. I think I can agree with that. It's a ticking time bomb. And like I said, F1 is an expensive sport. Channel 4 is actually pretty profitable at the moment. That's what I can afford to take this on. How long they take it on for, I don't know. The problem is they can't compete with Sky, because Sky are making bank on their Sky Sports. Like, the thing is, Sky makes most of its money on sports. They don't get it on, you know, they got your average, you got your phone bills, your broadband and whatnot. But at the same time, they've also got a sports package that costs £30 a month that people will pay for because they can't live without their football.
Exactly.
So, you know, when you bundle that in, you're going to have a lot of suckers out there that don't know what the internet is. Now, I don't condone piracy on this podcast, but let's be real here. I look at it like, so who's got a stream for this race?
Yep.
So when more people,
especially
start...
for guys our age who can't stump up like $10 a month, like I can just about do it for the WWE network that you've just mentioned, but for a lot of people, it's like, I remember when the BBC Sky deal was announced and the comment vitriol on the BBC website was huge, but there was a section of people going, oh, well, if you're a true fan of F1, you'll pay whatever. And there were a lot of people going, well, for some of us, that's not a question. We physically can't.
No.
We'd want to, but we just can't justify it. You know, if we're paying rent, food, blah, especially if you're students.
God.
Exactly. You know that feel. We were recently there.
You all are. King still is.
Yeah, exactly.
You just can't justify it. So that's the big issue with subscription TV services. And, you know, internet services, like the reason Netflix has been such success is, and the WWE network, there's so much stuff on there that you can justify paying it. Like on the WWE network, you get every single pay-per-view on there. Mm-hmm. You get an archive of hundreds of thousands of pay-per-views stretching all the way back for about 30 years. Imagine if F1 did something like that. You get exclusive TV shows on the network. You get TV shows that go out in America, stuff like NXT goes out on there. So you basically have so much content all in one place that it almost becomes, if you are a fan of that, you can't not have it.
And we're a market that leans towards paying for convenience, so it only makes the most sense for that to be kind of thing. So it's going to be interesting to see how that goes 5-10 years down the road.
Yeah,
but
offering that they have right now is fairly lackluster. Like, I paid for the F1 Extra service for this year, which offered, I think, live timing, some exclusive videos, and that was pretty much it. And it was fairly lackluster. And for about, I'm going to cancel it for this season, and I'm going to consider signing up for WRC Plus, which has basically the entire World Rally Championship coverage for the entire year for the same price. Onboard footage, aerial footage, everything live.
Ooh, yep. Tasty. So, you know,
it's good stuff.
The problem is that F1 would never do that because they don't have to, because they're trying to monopolize all their coverage and they make their money that way.
Well, so let's be honest.
Why would they bother to be innovative when they got guaranteed money off the TV coming in still?
Yeah, exactly. Well, Bernie Eccleston has kind of showed, I mean, I know he's not exclusively the guy, but I think he showcased very much the FOM attitudes in saying that he knows, or he wants to go after the older generation, the guys who are probably keeping traditional television going, because the older generation are living longer. You know, there's not enough of us yet to kind of facilitate that transition. And those are the guys Bernie's are interested in. The older guys with money to burn, who don't mind paying whatever for a subscription telly package, you know, even if they pay, because you have to pay extra for the F1 channel on Sky Sports. But he's going after those people who can afford the expensive watches that are sponsoring the cars or whatever, or providing the engines in Red Bull's case. That's weird. Or, you know, he's going after those people with the disposable income who just say, oh, you know what? I'll spend whatever on F1. He's going after the people who will spend whatever they have to watch F1. He's not necessarily caring, and FOM aren't necessarily caring about us lot, the guys who maybe would, but we kind of physically can't a lot of the time.
Yeah, so we're going to take a quick musical break while I get my Johnny Walker and Rolex out. We'll see you after this one real quick. Are you back off your Johnny Walker, Rolex and cigar? If so, strap right in for part two of the podcast. And, oh God, here we go. It's that
what
time
it,
of the, it's that time of the year again. It's January. There's not much of a story. Someone stuck a microphone in Jean Todt's face again. And we've got to talk about refueling.
Oh, that thing that most world motorsport can get right, but F1 can't.
Sadly, folks, it's that time of year again. Somebody interviewed Jean Todt King, and the long and the short of it was they were going to try and put refueling talk back on the table again for this season or for next season. Well, fill me in, King.
Silly season.
Basically, Todt said that refueling would be back on the table for inclusion to F1, maybe for 2017. And the team bosses are not happy about this at all.
No. Now, why would they not be happy about this, King?
For various reasons, like obviously cost was cited, safety was cited, which to me I find partly ridiculous. Yeah. And then Claire Williams also cited that it's not good for F1's image, that it could make F1 look like a gas guzzling sport.
I just say that might be the funniest thing that Claire Williams, your bae, has ever said, King. Quite frankly, because like it's like. I'm going to address this one real quick here. F1, a sport of this year, is going to have a 21-race calendar this year. The biggest F1 season ever.
That's a carbon footprint.
In a sport where you do thousands, if not millions of air miles, carrying big, weighty equipment around the world, and you're worried that the fuel is going to hurt the sport's image as a gas guzzler. Are you kidding me?
F1, you know, that real sport for the working class hero.
Of course. That's totally what I was thinking. Claire, I'm sorry. No, that's not how this works.
That's like, not a valid one.
I don't know. Like, she's a smart woman. I don't know how she could come out with something so stupid. Like, how did you get to the coat? How did you get to Kota, Claire? What, rowing? Like, no, that's not how this works.
To be honest, in amongst all that, of those concerns, I mean, as King pointed out, you know, well, as we all pointed out, the concern about the image, I'm sorry, for Formula One, the ultimate playboy display of excess and sporting excess, really. Worrying about gas guzzling, I'm sorry, that's kind of... The horse bolted about 60 years ago when Grand Prix racing started on that one. Safety?
I don't know. I'd argue against that, but go on.
To a degree. Yeah, to a degree.
We're not having James Hunt plowing the grid cars every week. We're not quite as bad as what we were in the 70s.
No, exactly. I mean, things have changed.
Anyone with half a brain cell would know that's just not how this sport works.
No, of course. Safety? I dispute that to a degree, considering most other major motorsport series in the world managed to do refueling okay. NASCAR, IndyCar, the World Endurance Championship, GT Series around the world.
All of them!
All of them, effectively. Even the British Touring Car Championship used to do it when they had... I don't know if they actually did fuel when they did their feature race pit stops in the 1990s. Anyway, basically, at the top level, safety, you know, it's going to... V8 Supercars, of course, does it. But I think the big issue here, the big problem, and the reason why most of the teams aren't happy with it, is that it's going to be a lot of cost. It's going to be more changes to the car, having not long ago outlawed refueling. I mean, when did refueling go away?
2010,
yeah. There you go. So 5 years later or 6 years later, it's potentially coming back. And I think the big thing is it's going to be a lot of cost. It's going to be a lot of unnecessary changing in that. For what benefit? I mean, IndyCar, for example, manages to add... or have refueling add an extra element to the Grand Prix, to their races, and that's alongside tyre strategy and things like that. But when F1 used to have refueling, it didn't seem to work the same way. Everyone kind of settled into a similar pattern.
It didn't work the same way because IndyCar had oval races where you had to stop for fuel anyway. There was no getting around that. F1 obviously made that problem avoidable by having no refueling for the last 5 years already.
So they had to have fuel tanks that could last the entire race.
Exactly. So for me, like, I have no major qualms with refueling. The issue I have is that the fans are obviously bloodlusting for this to come back because it's another reminder of the 2000 era, which many people still moonshine like no tomorrow.
Nostalgia.
Nostalgia, everybody's favourite buzzword of the week. But the thing is that people obviously just want to have the illusion of unpredictability. Like, if they had refueling in this era, it would not have made a damn difference to the championship because Mercs were just that sodding good. Putting Vettel on an alternate fuel strategy wasn't going to suddenly make him a winner. That's not how this has ever really worked. So, for me, I don't see what you really gain from having refueling in Formula 1 other than the illusion of unpredictability and the illusion of... And I put this in inverted commas. You can't see it behind this, obviously, the video, or in case you're listening to it on download. The illusion they're going flat out. We all had that last
year. It seems that refueling tends to be the most decisive issue around for pretty much no gain or loss whatsoever because... It seems to be decisive not only within, like, the organizing body and the team owners, but also the fans themselves. There's no middle ground here. It seems like you either like it or you absolutely hate it. It seems to be more decisive than Donald Trump right now.
Make F1 great again.
Okay.
Yeah, make the cars go flat out. It's none of that car management bollocks we've had for 30 years already. Let's see these guys at their best and have drivers make more mistakes. mistakes, even though we all mock Pastel when he does. But
this a case of, once again, the internet has about 50 million different ways to fix F1?
Yeah, and none of them actually feasible.
No.
Or realistic, or would actually make a difference. It's just one of those things where we all saw it in the GPDA survey last year, which pretty much went to prove that F1 fans have no idea what they actually want their F1 to be. And there's a million different scenarios to me as to what they want F1 to be. And refueling, I've watched enough F1 through the last 10 years to realize changing fuel at pit stops really didn't really make much of a difference to me. Like, I don't think... I've never watched the race, sat down and thought, if they brought the refueling back, this would certainly have made the race better.
I don't think so, especially when you've got alternate compound tyres now, and I think the idea to have a free choice of the compounds for any given weekend next year, I think that's a good move. That further mixes up the strategy. That's the sort of thing they should be looking to do.
Yeah, so that, you know, there's feasible... It's feasible alternatives are out there. People are working to try and make this work. The problem is, it's the ones that people don't like. Yeah. Because people have used Pirelli as a scapegoat for years enough as it is. So, for me, refueling, I'm with King on this one. I don't see what it brings to the table. I don't see what it adds to anything really in terms of a race and whatnot. So, yeah, it'll inevitably get shot down because the team bosses don't like it, and I can see why, because again, they're asking to spend even more money in a sport that's already ludicrously expensive.
Now, here's the thing. Refueling could be cost effective, but the team owners choose not to make it cost effective.
What's the kicker, King? Go on.
Yeah, back when they had refueling, the fueling rigs that they used were hydraulically powered. They were like refuelers that you'd probably see like at Heathrow Airport that they use to refuel like massive airliners. While in IndyCar and the WEC, they use cheaper gravity-fed fuelers. So it's fed by, the force of gravity. Yep. And it's fairly cheap. It only takes like two people to operate. While the airport refuelers needs about four or five crew members to operate.
Yeah, we all saw though back in those days of F1 where you'd have four people on the fuel gun, and if a fuel gun didn't go right, you'd have like half a dozen people in the back trying to fix it and whatnot, and it was ludicrous. So, yeah, I mean, there's alternatives here, but the teams don't like alternatives. They don't like the status quo. They don't like change. Most of us don't like change, so it's not going to happen. You know, it's just that time of the month again. It's like it's F1's time of the month, so to speak. So to talk about refueling, and it's never actually going to happen. And that certain event, I'm not going to talk about it anymore. So we're going to move on to another woman. Oh, great. Segue. Susie Wolf, the newly retired former Formula One test driver and DTM driver, launched a new incentive, or at least a new program at the Autosport event this past weekend called the Dare to be Different initiative. King, tell us a bit more about it, would you? Because, this is like your makeshift Susie Wolf report for the last time.
It lives on.
I thought it would die as sweet, sweet death.
Nope. She's still relevant, King. She's still relevant. You can't get rid of her.
Yeah, so the Dare to be Different initiative launched by Susie Wolf in association with the British Motorsport Association. You know, it hopes to encourage young women to be interested in participating in motorsport, not only as drivers, but also behind the scenes as, mechanics, engineers, the whole picture. And they plan to do this by having, I think they have five scheduled events this year that they're going to have at karting circuits to introduce girls to karting and motorsport in general. And alongside that, they're also going to have an online community where girls can come in contact with, ambassadors with the program, Claire Williams, Susie Wolf, Rachel Brooks, and Alice Powell.
Yeah, now this sounded all great on paper. The announcement was very slick, and there was a nice little selfie booth you could get in the Autosport show because everyone loves a good selfie. And it all looked nice. The announcement was pretty shrewd. I liked it. I read it over. It seemed pretty reasonable on paper. Couple of problems though, King. Would you like to explain the first one? It was mainly to do with the website itself.
To access the online portion of the initiative, you need to pay a community fee of £25 a month. I mean, £25 a year.
I was going to say, if it was £25 a month, I think it just jumped out of the window from now. But yeah, you have to pay £25 a year to access the online features of this initiative. Now, let's be real here again. Motorsport is not a cheap sport to invest in. It is hard to get into motorsport on a grassroots level. I mean, if you've ever watched any form of grassroots racing, what's the first thing a driver or racer does? Thank their sponsors, because they're the ones that are keeping them there.
Yep.
It's a hard sport to get into on any level. We've all seen the story of Lewis Hamilton and his dad having to work 3 jobs to keep his son's dream alive. We've all heard those stories. So let me get this straight. In a sport that struggles on a grassroots level, you're introducing an incentive that you have to pay to be a part of. Who said this was a good idea?
Probably the website designer.
No clue. No clue.
I've got to make my cut, bruh.
I mean, I don't think the fee is as extortionate as it could be. I mean, generally, if you are in motorsport, that's the sort of fee that you could get off a sponsor at a low level. But at the same time, the ethos doesn't sound right.
It doesn't send the right message.
No, it doesn't. Not at all.
It doesn't. It's more the message than the price itself. That, you know, we should be encouraging. Ultimately, they want to encourage participation. Make it free. Like, you give people as much of a net as possible for them to be sporting.
Or at least have a free sign-up option.
Yeah, like, maybe even just like a free trial for the first year, just to see if you're interested or something along those lines, because, like, telling people to get involved at that kind of price point, especially if you're under the age of 18 and you probably can't afford to just drop 25 quid on something like that.
You're already,
like,
paying for a load of tires and that in karting, for example.
Like, how are you going to convince your parents that this is actually worthwhile? Especially if you believe you're actually any good. Because if you think you're any good, you'd say, why would you need that kind of incentive?
I mean, and as a nonprofit organization, they can accept donations, and right beside the sign up for, you know, the £25 a year, they have an option for, it's like, oh, would you like to make a donation? You could give a donation to the organization.
But what's the point?
Yeah.
Hold up, like, what? What's the point in them having a pay option? Why not have a free sign up, and then if you get something out of it, then you have the choice to donate?
You know, like a Patreon page or something.
Plug, 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 plug.
Or even like a crowdfunding campaign or something along those lines.
Absolutely.
Like, that would have made a lot more sense than going down the straight-up subscription model, because, nobody likes subscription costs unless it's their Xbox Live account. That's just one of these things. unless you absolutely have to pay it or you see the value in it, if you can help it, you won't pay that kind of money.
That's a difficult thing. I mean, you hit it right there. Seeing the value in it, a lot of people will be skeptical coming out because they know that motorsport is a difficult world enough as it is to encourage women to get involved. I mean, the This Girl Can campaign has done a pretty good job in encouraging participation at a grassroots level for women in sport in general. So I kind of see this. I thought this was where they were going with this in terms of a motorsport specific thing. Mm-hmm. The subscription thing sounds out the wrong message. And I think, you know, maybe a cheaper or at least a free option with premium features to sign up for if you have the money to do so, I think that would probably work better to get people in, because then you get testimonials flowing and you get a good rep. You know, it's the basics of building a brand and a company.
How any young business would start, you get the word out there.
Exactly.
You don't open up and charge a big fee to get people through the door.
I guess they're probably
the
banking on the Susie Wolf name.
And the testimonials they get from people like I said before, Alice Powell, Rachel Brooks, and Claire Williams saying that this is an organization that girls should be a part of.
Yeah, that's one thing. But also, the other problem I have with something like this is that how are you going to get people of the world to come to Scotland for these events?
Well, that's another thing. It's not meant for people outside the United Kingdom because of their deal with the MSA. It's only British. It's British based. It's only for Britain.
That doesn't help.
But I guess it's a start for in the UK. If Susie Wolf's obviously British, she's raised here, she's trying to give back to the grassroots in this country. So I suppose I get the vibe from it that she is trying to make things not... She's trying to help women coming up in British motorsport and have them sort of avoid some of the problems that she probably faced coming up through. And I think overall, the ethos of it is fantastic. Isn't this, I mean, I'd much rather have initiatives like this than an all-female Formula One series with four cars on the grid that no one cares about and no female driver actually wants to enter anyway. Because as, you know, another a British club racing driver, Abby Eaton, correctly said, no female race driver wants to be the best female driver in the world. They want to be the best race driver in the world.
It's a matter of inclusion. It's a matter of inclusion. And you got to start that by opening up the doors on a grassroots level. And I only hope that this doesn't curtail what is a great incentive and what, you know, on paper is a fantastic thing that's, you know, that we do need a more female presence in Formula One on every level, in my opinion. And, you know, it's not just a driver's perspective. It's, I mean, how many women do you see in the average F1 team garage, for example? There's not many out there.
Well,
I think
an organization like this should promote the various uses of roles for women in sport. I mean, this would be a perfect way to deal with the whole grid girls debate that we've been having in the last year or so. You know, if you're a woman in motorsport, that's not the only thing you have a role for in motorsport, to sit around looking pretty. You can be, like, for example, a Lena Gade, who is a Le Mans winning engineer for Audi. Be someone like a Kim Stevens, who was the most people will know as the woman who got drenched with champagne by Lewis Hamilton on the Abu Dhabi podium. But she's, I believe, a strategist and an engineer for the Mercedes Grand Prix team.
Yep.
Be someone like
an American.
Of course.
I had to get that
plug
there,
King.
Had to get that one in there, didn't you, King?
By the way, she's one of ours.
Yay!
But yeah, all that sort of thing. And I'm glad that the campaign. I mean, I was there on the Thursday at Autosport when it was launched, and there was a good sort of buzz on the ground about it. It was a good enthusiasm, and if it persuades even some women to get into motorsport at whatever level they want to, as a staff member, engineer, team owner, racer, whatever, then more power to it. Mazel tov to it. It's done its job.
Yes, and I can only hope that the approach they've taken, despite that, which I still don't think is the right move, I still wish them the greatest success.
Absolutely.
And I hope they can raise the female profile of motorsport in general, because I still see many people on their timelines talk about how, you know, the female presence isn't really a thing, and they want to play the whole reverse sexism game with me, and I don't like it.
Let's put it this way. I hope that this campaign, and I have a feeling this campaign, can be far more progressive for women in Formula One than signing Carmen Jordan.
Yes,
and we'll talk about that in the Q&A section. There's a very interesting question regarding that, and we'll be talking about that in a bit.
What was shocking to me, like, at first I was going to make a video about this, but then it just expanded to a full-blown report. I haven't finished the report yet, but the participation numbers for women in Britain are horrendously low.
They really
are. MSA's entry-level single-seater championship, formerly Formula 4, now MSA Formula, over the past seven seasons, there's been about one female driver for about 40 men.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's entry level.
So that's about 2.5%.
Yeah, and that can sort of, I think in a way that can sort of backfire into a sort of pressure on whoever does come through. We sort of end up getting behind those who do come through. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, Sophia Fleurs, the young German driver, made a big impact in Ginetta Juniors last year, but then quit halfway through the season. And I believe she's looking to do a full season in German Formula 4 this year. She has Formula 1 ambitions.
She's already signed on. Yeah, she's already signed on to do a full season.
Right. Yeah, there we go. And I think a lot of people, I think sometimes there are so few women in these major roles that the ones who do get there feel like they're under in a real sort of goldfish bowl, you know, because we sort of, a lot of us got behind Susie Wolf, I think, because, hey, it was better than nothing. No disrespect to Susie at all. She's, you know, a talented race driver. She had her place. She did well in DTM for what she had there. But I think a lot of people, as you said, Dre, it's almost the other way. It's rather than knocking them because they're a woman, you praise them even more so than they probably deserve because they're a woman and you won't see a woman at the top level. So it's very hard. And the ultimate aim of this campaign, I hope, is to almost take the gender out of it and make talent the only consideration. Gender it shouldn't matter. In an ideal world, it shouldn't. Unfortunately, it does. Let's try and minimize that and make it about the most talented drivers making it to the top. Male, female, whatever.
Yeah, like
non-binary as well. I'm sorry.
For like a certain perspective, I know how they feel because being an American, there are very few Americans. Mm-hmm. When there's an American, they get extra scrutiny or praise because they're an American.
Yeah, and that shouldn't be a thing. But yeah, absolutely agree to both of you on that one. Speaking of talented drivers, Pastor Maldonado. Again, I segue
good one,
so
Dre.
Well, don't I? Yeah. I mentioned this before off the air. I said before how I call this segment the Renault shit because there's almost guaranteed to be a story coming out of Enstone with F1 these days because it's never quiet down that part of the F1 world
for some reason.
Like, every podcast, there's something going on down there. And here's the latest story. Pastor Maldonado apparently on the brink of losing his seat because his sponsors are paying late. And it basically goes hand in hand with the rumors going around that Kevin Magnussen was seen in Enstone last week talking to Renault about a potential seat, maybe a third driver role, etc. Now,
the darling of Twitter returns.
I don't like talking about Pastor because there's no middle ground on Pastor.
No,
Maldonado.
I wasn't talking about Pastor. I was talking about Kevin Magnussen, the greatest driver not in F1.
I was getting to that. Like it's like there's already one thing with Pastor going on because like there's no middle ground on him. It's either everybody like wants to defend him at every given opportunity, while on the other end, everybody can't wait to bash him whenever he messes up. And then you put
or even when he doesn't.
Yeah, even when he doesn't to a degree, because his name was thrown around a lot last year when half of the time it wasn't actually his fault that he was taken out of a race or whatever. So there's no middle ground on Pastor. And when you combine that with Kevin Magnussen, who is a real internet darling driver, Magnussen's not bad by any stretch of the imagination, but he wasn't that great the one year he was in F1 in the first place. So when you combine Pastor's situation with Kevin's situation, it's a bit like making one of those volcanoes you see in those science experiments in America. You're going to get an overflow and you're going to get an eruption of hype train because people are desperate to see another young'un in Formula One again. Like, I've said it before, like, it used to be the talk of, we don't want paid drivers in F1. Now it's a talk of, I don't want that paid driver in F1.
Yeah.
Like, so we've become more specific over the years. It's like, we want young talent in F1. No, not that one, that guy.
Not Jolyon Palmer.
No, that guy. Like, Jolyon Palmer is 24, and people are talking like he's 36 or something. So, you know, it's already a rough enough situation it is, and the perception of pay drivers in Formula One has never been a particularly healthy one. But King, you're the Magnussen fan around here.
No pressure.
You're the Magnussen meme maker on this. You talk about this a bit more because it's a confusing one.
On the Kevin Magnussen side of things, I don't see him getting the race seat. It seems more likely that he's going to become Renault's new reserve driver because they signed on the reserve driver to the race seat.
That's true. That's true. Jolyon Palmer, of course.
Yeah. And on the Pastor side of things, it's so much more complex and nuanced than anyone on the internet's making this out to be. Number one, PDVSA, billion-dollar oil company. The reason why they're late on payments is because Venezuela is going to it's terrible right now. Inflation skyrocketing, their economy is on the brink of collapse, and PDVSA represents about half the country's economy. So when the rest of the economy is crashing, someone has to fit the bill, and that's pretty much them.
Yeah, so with Venezuela's oil reserves and economy in general going down the shitter, of course it's going to have a knock-on effect for Pastor, who is heavily sponsored by said company.
Well, this sounds a lot like the situation with Mikhail Aloshin, or however you pronounce his surname. And a similar thing with SMP Racing, who were sponsored by, was it the Russian government, or was it a Russian sort of high-up businessy? Yeah,
bank.
Russian bank, the SMP bank, isn't it?
And to even make an even more relevant example, Felipe Massa had the same talk around him because he was sponsored by Petrobras, and they had an enormous bill at their doorstep last year. So that was obviously talk about Massa not being able to race next year, which, you know, is not actually happening. But again, we've seen these stories come up before, but because it's Pastor, I think people have reacted, you know, more favorably in this regard, or made more of a fuss about it, because it's a guy that people don't really want to see in Formula One, even though, while Pastor is no Romain Grosjean, he's no Nico Hülkenberg, he's not on that tier with those kinds of dudes, I don't think Pastor is anywhere near as bad as the internet wants to think he is.
The problem is the internet still thinks this is 2012. I mean, when Grosjean was announced at Haas, I genuinely saw people on Twitter saying, they've just hired that guy who crashes on the first lap. I'm like, really? 2012 is 4 years ago now. Have you not paid attention to what Roman's been doing since then?
And people don't talk about that absolutely exceptional run he made in the second half of 2013, where he was legitimately challenging for wins. He was the biggest threat.
And of course, he got that podium last year for Lotus.
Yeah, of course.
On the same weekend, they had bailiffs at their trucks.
Yeah, like, people forget Grosjean is a top world-class driver. There's no doubt about that. Anyone that still wants to bury Grosjean for 2012 is an idiot at this point in time, quite frankly, because they've clearly chosen selective memories to...
Just not been paying attention.
Yeah, they've not been paying attention. It's as simple as that. And while Pastor, like I said, while Pastor is no prize, it's a situation where he's 31 in April. He's entering year six. If he really was that bad, he would not still be here. Mm. And like I said, he's entering year six of his F1 career now. Like, are we not all just bored of making Pastor jokes at this point? Like, I know it's an easy Twitter favorite from, like, 12-year-olds on the internet, but Pastor is not as bad as people like to think he is.
At this point, he makes no more mistakes than any other driver in F1. In fact, after Sebastian Vettel's Mexico Grand Prix of last year, I have to say, I don't think Maldonado even had a race that was that bad all of last year. So.
No, he didn't. And at least I'd like to think he did. I know I still remember the Sky Sports F1 team giving him a -1 out of 10 score for China, even though he was taken out by Jenson Button that day. So people like to use the stick of the past to beat Pastor with.
And let's not forget, Lotus have been on a real downer the last 2 years. 2014, their car was dreadful. I mean, it was the car that made Romain Grosjean lose his temper in Singapore, and that's something you never see from Grosjean. And 2015 was a lot better, but still, you know, there was the worst of the
Merckx teams.
Yeah, exactly, and there was still a big axe hanging over them over the unpaid bills. I mean, was it in Japan they couldn't get into their own hospitality?
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been a nightmare for the drivers.
Yeah.
So Maldonado came into that team in fairly difficult circumstances. So
let's put it to you this way. Would you rather see Pastor on the grid, or would you rather see no Lotus team at all?
End
of discussion. I'm going to take another break before those words resonate with you, and we'll be back for the Q&A segment of the podcast. This time around. Now, time for your questions in the Q&A section of the show. Thanks to everybody that sent a question in, and we will tackle them as follows. I'm going to start right at the top with an IndyCar question from good friend of the show, Mr. Daniel Brennan. Hello, sir. Who says, seeing as Helio, TK, and JPM are getting on a bit in age and may retire within a few seasons, who do you guys see as the top three young prospects to take their places in Penske and Ganassi once they're retired? I'd personally have Newgarden, Karam, and seriously, Connor Daly, simply because they will have a lot of IndyCar experience, but I'd like to hear your guys' thoughts. So, we're talking about Penske. They have a couple of older gents on their team, most likely Helio Castroneves and Juan Pablo Montoya. We've obviously got, you know, TK, who's, I think, touching 40 now.
Yep.
As one of their drivers as well.
Scott Dixon's fairly senior as well. I think he's in his mid-30s.
Dixon's up there in age. You know, it's... We've talked about this on the podcast before, King. IndyCar's kind of an old man's game, but because it's a borderline spec series, you know, the more experience you get, most likely the better you're going to end up being. So where do you see it? Because I think it's fair to say Joseph Newgarden is one of those names.
Yeah, Joseph Newgarden's one of those names, but I think one name that was left out, James Hinchcliffe, he's probably the top of everyone's guy who's currently not in a big team because he chose to left Andretti.
That's true. And he was a race winner in that Andretti team.
Yeah, he was a race winner. He's number one on the top of any big team list to get signed to a big team.
I mean, you don't really associate Hinch with that because he's 28 and he's been around for a good while now, but yeah, Hinch... In the context of IndyCar at 28, that actually is still pretty young for IndyCar. So, yeah, like I can totally buy Hinchcliffe being one of those dudes because, you know, he walked away from a very prolific, obviously one of the most prolific IndyCar outfits in Andretti as a race because he wanted to be the big fish, so to speak. He didn't really want to, compete constantly against, you know, guys like Ryan Hunter-Reay and, you know, Marco Andretti, obviously a very, very strong, consistent team. And, you know, he wanted to be the big guy at Schmidt-Peterson. So if... I mean, Hinchcliffe's one of those guys. Joseph Newgarden had a fantastic season last year as a real breakout star of the series. Obviously, Graham Rahal had an unbelievable season for Honda, pretty much carrying the whole of all of Honda Motorsport on its back for that calendar year, given how bad the MotoGP team was and how McLaren Honda got along. The one saving grace was Graham Rahal almost winning the IndyCar Championship last year. So, with that being a thing, I think. I mean, if you've got anyone else you want to add, Johnson, go for it. But
there's a few from in Indy Lights at the moment, and a guy who I believe is going to be making his race debut this year, reigning Indy Lights champion Spencer Pigot. I definitely like the look of him. He's going to be running a partial schedule with Rahal Letterman Lanigan.
Yes,
I
want to say, right.
Because he'll be running St. Petersburg, the Indy Grand Prix, and the 500. Ed Jones is also a very good shout from down there, as is Jack Solid Harvey. Mate. And... a guy who, I mean, obviously people are going to know this guy from his exploits in F1, but I don't joke about this. Max Chilton, he's only 24. Excuse me?
My phone went off too early. Don't worry about it.
Oh, okay. I thought it was just like, ding, ding, ding. You've got one there.
Yeah, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the latest rumor going around today was that Chilton is talking to people and possibly the number 8 car at Ganassi race in the the part-time car that was shared by Sage Karam, who had a fantastic season last year and shared it with Sebastian Saavedra part-time. There's a chance that Chilton, who is well-funded, could take that number 8 car next season. So we could
see.
So yeah, that'd be a huge for Ganassi Racing to have a fourth full-time driver out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And the big thing with Max Chilton is that I remember speaking to him at the Nismo LMP1 launch last year. Obviously, he was a driver with those guys before that program wrapped up. And he said he deliberately went to Indy Lights because he knew just how much of a culture change it was. And he also wanted to learn the ovals. And I think what's big with Max Chilton is not only did he do very, very well on the road courses, as he was expected to do in Indy Lights, he also got his one and only win for the season on the oval at Iowa, which is one of the more difficult and tricky ovals on the schedule. So I think that's alerted some of the big teams in IndyCar looking at this guy going, okay, we know this guy has road course pedigree, especially from Formula One. We know this guy's funded. Crucially, he's doing a very good job at switching over to the one thing that a lot of European drivers struggle with in America, which is oval racing. So I think that puts Max Chilton right in the prime position. It's Marshall Pruitt who's reporting this rumor about him going to Ganassi.
Good source.
A good source, yes. Apparently there's discussions been happening there. I think if he goes to the 8 car, he's going to fly. I think he'll be awesome.
That'd be a great addition to the series. I'd love to see Max Chilton in IndyCar, where the cool kids are at these days in the motorsport world.
Also,
and
it should be noted
right now that Max Chilton does not have a seat in lights this year. The other Carlin seat is going to the Puerto Rican Felix Sorales.
Yeah.
Yes.
Also, one more guy to speak about. This is going to be a little bit of a left field choice. Sean Rahal. not spelt the same way as Graham Rahal, but he has done quite a bit of IMSA racing, normally in the LMPC class. He's run the SCCA Pro Formula, easy enough for me to say. And last year, he did a partial schedule for 8-Star Motorsports in Indy Lights and won 2 races.
So
he ran 9 races and won 2 of them at Indianapolis and at Mid-Ohio. So in a partial schedule in Indy Lights, he did very, very well. We're talking about young guys here. This kid is 21 this year. He's got plenty of time on his side.
Absolutely. There's a talent right there, one to keep an eye on for the future. Right, next question from Miles Pardo on Twitter, who asks, why are people criticizing Bernie when he's just saying what we know to be true, RE women? Now, this is a question that was based on the comments that Bernie made about a female driver being in Formula 1 a couple of days ago. I think it was on some kind of, I think it was a Canadian radio station he said these comments on, or something along those lines, where he basically said that if we had a woman in Formula 1, she wouldn't be taken seriously anyway. Now, I know a couple of people reacted very angrily to this, and now I said it before, I think it's because it's come from Bernie and not from someone who's a bit more respected, because I think another internet trait is people love to throw shade at Bernie even though he doesn't completely talk out of his ass all the time. And
it's just when he does, it's pretty notable.
Yeah, it does. And you know, I'm not saying he doesn't put his foot in it sometimes, but this is not one of those occasions, in my opinion. And I know Pippa Man reacted very angrily to this because she's a female driver in IndyCar, obviously, and she's done so much for charity as a female driver, and obviously that's fantastic. But I think Bernie's right. I just think we're looking in the wrong area. I don't think that the people within Formula One would be disrespectful towards a female driver. I think the fans would be the ones that would be disrespectful towards a female driver if they were in it. We still live in a very bigoted, sexist society in the world. That's just how it is. And
given
how much shade we threw at Carmen Jorda just this past year, even though she was just doing her job at the end of the day, and how much was the cameras focused on Carmen Jorda over the course of the last year in Formula One, I don't think the disrespect is coming from F1. I think it's coming from us. That's the problem.
Well, I think an example of what you were just saying there about how society's attitudes are still taking a lot longer to change than we'd like to believe. Here's a good example for you. Was it the FIFA 16 announcement? That it would feature female teams. There was about 500 comments on that post in about 5 minutes. 95% of them involved jokes about going to the kitchen and making me a sandwich.
That's just the kind of society we live in still.
Someone shoot me in the head.
And people are... We live in a society driven by Facebook likes and Twitter likes, and that's the kind of thing that will obviously get the banter side of the sporting world on point by saying things like that. And I mean, if you ever see an ESPN Facebook post, you will always see the same things like, the Seahawks should have ran the ball, like based on the last year's Super Bowl. You could easily see things like, but could they beat the 96 Bulls because of Steph Curry's recent run just destroying the NBA right now? Things like that. It's the same kind of deal here.
And people say, oh, it's not sexism, it's just a joke.
But it's a sexist joke.
Yes, it's terrible.
It's terrible. And you know, this stopped being funny about 10 years ago. Like, I know people are going to say to me, oh, well, people bash Carmen Jorda because she's bad, not because she's a woman. Yeah.
Which you did.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You can't really differentiate on this one. Like, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's just one of those situations where we are a bad society. Like we are still a long way to go, I think, from truly embracing a female driver. I think we've done better with it in other disciplines like Formula E, for example, and Simona, which I'll get to in the next question. But on the whole, I think Bernie's right. I just think he's right in the wrong source of area, because I never heard any negative stories about Susie being in Formula One from within the paddock itself.
Yep.
It was always negative stories from us as fans. And now, don't get me wrong, some criticism was valid for Susie, like her credentials and whatnot. But at the same time, we are still in a make me a sandwich kind of world. So,
well, I mean, it's sort of like what you were saying earlier with the Maldonado thing, where there is no middle ground with him. Driver, very similar to that, Danica Patrick. in NASCAR. Oh my goodness. There is no middle ground with her whatsoever. She is either the shining hope for female drivers worldwide or an absolute joke who only gets any rides that she does in motorsport because she did a swimsuit issue of Sport Illustrated. And it does my head in, because it's almost like, at the end of the day, all you want is people to judge her on her race results. And to be fair, I was being a little bit facetious with your comment about Carmen Jordan, because when you did that Dre TV episode, you were saying Jordan doesn't deserve the place in Formula One based on pure credentials. Mm-hmm. And it's the similar thing with Danica Patrick. You look at her record, it's nowhere near as bad as most people would say it is. It's not quite as good as other people would say. So it's an incredibly difficult. It's the woman drivers thing again. They're either placed on a impossible pedestal, mm-hmm. or denigrated just because, bitch, get back in the kitchen. And yes, we are still a lot more Neanderthal than I think people like to admit. Hey, yeah. I got another question right.
Yay.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, and its phone response means that was a good answer.
Thank you.
Yes.
Do I get a cookie?
It's in the mail.
Hey.
Is your phone still going off, Johnson? For God's sake.
No, it was my phone.
That's not my phone.
Oh my God, what is that? Okay. It's fixed now.
Thanks, Ryan.
Cookie buzzer.
You're real professional.
Yeah. I don't know why it's like, oh, anytime Johnson talks, let's just ring one.
Yep. It's like, it's a message. segueing nicely from talking about Simona briefly for a minute there, a question from Josh Sutil, big fan of the show. Hi, Josh. He says, Simona Di Silvestro, discuss below par Formula E season so far. Should she prioritize IndyCar? Interesting question, because Simona, I don't think, has scored a point in Formula E so far since she got there with two different teams. I know she filled in during the London finale in season one, and she's now full time at the Amlin Andretti team for season two. And I don't think she's scored a point yet, and I think she's been kind of middle of the road since she got there. And it doesn't help that Robin Frins has had that podium in Putaraya during round two, where Frins pretty much drifted his way on the last three laps to a podium finish during that race. So the potential's there by the looks of it. And, you know, I know Robin Frins was a real internet darling as well a few years ago when he was knocking on the door of Formula One. But King, you know Simona well, obviously, from her IndyCar experience and, you know, doing a lot of racing in America. What do you figure of all this?
Like, to be honest, besides that podium, Andretti has literally been middle of the road. Like,
that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, Frins is, besides the podium, he has two 10th place finishes. Simona has an 11th from 11th and 12th last year, and then this season 13th and 11th. They've literally been middle of the road. I wouldn't say that Simona's underperforming. Yes, she's underperforming compared to Robin Frins, but you could say that Andretti is a pretty average team. The car that they brought is literally middle of the road.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with that. I think my first thought was basically that the team's been mediocre more than she's been mediocre, because the team has not really been that great. And Putaraya in its own right was a race that was littered with attrition and carnage. So no wonder Robin Frins had a higher finish than what was probably anticipated on paper. Yeah, go on, Adam.
And also, just to say, I know Robin Frins has been kind of listed as a bit of a internet darling, but to be honest, he's kind of backed that up recently. I mean, last year, in 2015, before he hooked up with the Formula E team and got in over there, he was running in Blancpain GT Series in Europe. Admittedly, he was partnered with Laurens Vanthoor, who's probably one of the greatest GT drivers in the world right now. But Frins at least has the record to back it up, and he's the man on current form. Whereas I feel like Di Silvestro has kind of been hindered by a career that's kind of gone a bit stop-start the last few years. She was in IndyCar. She tried to chase the F1 dream, ended up doing no racing for almost a year, and then the money ran out over there, and now she's back in Formula E. That's another different kind of car that she's adjusting to. So maybe just, you know, I know this is sounds like the ultimate cop-out excuse for a driver, but maybe a little bit more time to settle in to the style of racing Formula E might be useful for Di Silvestro. And of course, this year, what's really put the cat among the pigeons in Formula E is the limited amount of development. In the first year, it was almost a spec series. This year, we've now had teams starting to develop. And you fill me in on this one, Dre. And guys, I do not watch it as much as you guys do. has there been a lot more of a golf in teams because of the technological developments?
A little bit. Like, Edams is clearly the best team right now. Like, Edams is clearly number one. I think the Apt team are a bit stronger than what they were last year. I don't know how much of that is down to Lucas being a natural fit for the series, because Lucas is probably the best pound-for-pound guy in the series on paper. But there's been a bit more of a gap, and we're seeing a bit more consistency in the results compared to last year. Like, on paper, it looks like Edams and Dragon Racing are the two best teams on paper. Like, is that fair to say, King?
Yeah, I'd say that is exactly what I would put it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the Dutchman is clearly talented. I'd probably say he's the most talented driver in the past 5 years not to make it to F1. Like, right off the bat, second year in Formula BMW in 2010, he won that. Then Renault 2.0 next year won that. 3.5 the year after that won that. And then his career just stalled because he didn't have money.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, you know, the kid has been a success in just about everything he's put his hand to, but again, it's that age old Formula One problem. You know, you need a big amount of money to be able to compete on any level, and he's just one of those unlucky guys that's never had the open door for him. But and it's a bit unfair because Robin is a really talented guy, and that's the only real yardstick for Simona, and Simona is a very solid driver in her own right, and it's just you're comparing her to a real stud prospect in Robin Frins, which is just a shame. But I think it's more down to the Andretti team itself. It'll be one of the known strugglers. I think they're still on their season one power unit and gear train, because they've struggled so much to get their season 2-1 right. So
yeah, they're seventh out of nine teams right now.
Yeah, so it's I mean, Simona being middle of the field is actually about right, given where the car is right now. So you got to put a bit more emphasis on car development this year because of the way the series has gone out. So yeah, I think that's more the reason than Simona individually herself struggling. I think that one podium makes it look worse than what it actually is, so to speak. But that's just how I look at it anyway. Speaking of Formula E, Richard Evans have a quick question. What do you make of the Paris E-Prix circuit?
Location?
Beautiful.
You literally could not get a better location in Paris unless you're like racing down the Champs-Élysées. And they're literally racing around, you know, the military hospital in Valdez and Napoleon's tomb.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place to host this race. It is perfect for what you want to do for a Parisian race. Circuit itself, not bad. I think there's definitely a couple of places where you can definitely pull a pass on people, which I think is good enough. So I think we'll see some passing. I don't think it's going to be like the box circuit where it was very stop-starty and whatnot. Formula E's been a bit of a mixed bag for circuits so far, but I think Paris has potential to be one of the better ones. So I don't know if anything to that, Adam, but I think it's a beautiful location for it, and I think there's potential for it to be a real gem in the crown for Formula E as a race.
Well, there's two things about this. Number one, the fact they're racing around Paris, it reminds me, I think there was a fancy street track in Paris in Gran Turismo 4, and it sounds like that sort of fancy Gran Turismo circuit, which I love about it
that
straight
was
away.
Two, actually, yeah.
And number two, yeah, exactly. And number two, these sort of tracks and races are exactly what Formula E have been going for since the start. They've used, and you've got to give them credit for this, they have used their USP of being this electric-powered championship. Therefore, we're quiet enough to race in inner cities where normally noise restrictions put big issues on motorsport. They've used that USP so well to put themselves apart from any other series. You almost can't judge it alongside any other race series, which is probably a good thing compared to, you know, a lot of people criticized it for not being as fast, the cars not being as quick as other race cars. But really, Formula E have kind of forged completely their own, you know, their niche in terms of motorsport. They are alternative. They have this alternate technology in it. And as a result, they're using that to their advantage to have these very unique races in unique locations in major cities, bringing the motorsport to the masses right in the cities, not out in these big Grand Prix circuits that are often miles and miles out of town and quite difficult for the general public to get to outside of driving. You know, public transport for most circuits in the UK is a bit of a nightmare, but they've used this niche so well. And I think going to Paris and having such an iconic track location that features so many great historic tourist attractions and that, perfect. It's exactly what Formula E should be about, and well done to them.
Yep, couldn't agree more with that.
And I mean, Paris is undisputably the birthplace of motor racing. Mm. You could actually ride the Metro about like two stops down the line from the Formula E track to the park where the first motor race began.
There you go. Perfect.
Well, so there you go. I'm sure that will get any intro music in there somewhere. Next question from Matthew Linder says, ask Adam how he thinks Erebus will fare racing Holden's instead of Mercedes in this year's V8 Supercars. I don't watch V8 Supercars. Johnson, this one's all yours.
Thank you very much. Well, Erebus Racing, for a bit of context here, have, because I understand probably your listeners don't watch much V8 Supercars either. Erebus Racing, for the last few seasons, have raced Mercedes-Benz C63 AMG saloons. Now, V8 Supercars obviously was dominated for the longest time. It was exclusively open to Holdens and Fords. And they opened up the manufacturers a few years ago, and Nissan and Volvo joined. And Mercedes joined with Erebus, but they weren't a factory team. So they built the cars with Mercedes' permission, but Mercedes gave them no support along... To compare it, you know, Nissan have had a factory team, Volvo have had a factory team, and Volvo were challenging for the championship in their debut season in 2014. Whereas all along, Erebus and the incredibly charismatic Betty Klemenko, the team owner down there, one of the most popular in the pit lane down there, but they've really badly struggled without manufacturer support. And the thing is, Holden supports every single team that runs Holden cars to a degree. Obviously, it has its manufacturer team. Just like in Formula One, you know, you have Mercedes with the factory team, but you'll also have the other supported teams in terms of Williams, Lotus, etc. So Erebus moved into Holden this year. It's a shame we lose a different shell and style of car in V8 Supercars. But to be honest, from a competitive standpoint, if you're getting nothing from Mercedes and finishing 20th most races, or getting something from Holden, historically probably the most successful mark in Australian racing, which is going to annoy all the Ford fans, but hey, those two are the dominant, you know, the dominant forces of Australian racing, then you can entirely see the logic behind them, and I think it's going to be a good move for them.
Yeah, I'm not going to add anything to that. That's Johnson's domain. Thank God we've got him. Yeah, Joseph Hudson asks, and this is going to be one of those generic questions, how close do you think Ferrari will be to the Mercs?
Well,
anyone?
Can I just start this one?
Go on.
This was an interesting point that was made on, it was Radio Le Mans' Formula One end of season review show, and they had on Nick Damon, who used to work in the Formula One paddock as a reporter, and obviously is now with Radio Le Mans, and he made a very smart point, which not a lot of people have picked up on. Overall, if you look at the average pace across the season, Ferrari were just as far off the pace of the Mercs in 2015 as Red Bull and Williams were in 2014. So effectively, The narrative was, you know, obviously they got more race wins and they were able to beat them in certain areas where the track suited. But overall, what kind of more happened was that Ferrari became the second team behind Mercedes, and the whole idea that they made a, you know, really massively close the gap on Mercs and now they're going to be almost identical next year has kind of been blown massively out of proportion. Guys, opinions?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that, looking at the times throughout every Grand Prix this year, that Mercedes has pulled away from everyone, but Ferrari was the only team that kind of kept up. They haven't really gained on Mercedes.
Yeah, because remember, you've got to put it into context that where Ferrari were at the end of 2014 was a country mile away. Like, the fact they've already, like, pretty much cut that deficit in half is a testament to how brilliant they did with their car this year. And they beat Mercs three times on merit as opposed to Red Bull when they beat them three times and Mercs had a really bad day at the office.
Yeah.
So, it, like, that in itself is kind of like a moral victory for Ferrari. I don't see them having the legs to beat Mercedes next year because, like, my word, that's a big ask. I mean, you're looking at, what, the better part of 3/4 a lap? That's a big deficit to find, especially after a year which, under any circumstance, Ferrari would call a success. So, you know, it's a big ask for them from there, but, you know, I don't think they'll beat them. I think if they can just consolidate their second place from last season, I think they would take that. But obviously, Ferrari's aiming for the big one because that's what Ferrari do, and that might be part of the problem. Two more questions, I think, in this section here. We got one from Len Morrison. Hi, Len, who says, how vital is this upcoming F1 season for Red Bull's long-term future? Now, for me, the obvious answer is they're committed to 2020, unless they want to take a heavy financial penalty by quitting early. I think it's something like $100 million per year of, that they quit their contract early. King, is that right?
Yeah, it's about right.
Yeah, so it's $100 million for every year they pull out of the sport early before 2020, which is the agreement they committed themselves to five, I think it was something like 10 years ago they confirmed that. So, yeah, unless Red Bull want to pay a heavy exit fee to get out of Formula One, they're not going anywhere anytime soon. Don't let what Eddie Jordan would tell you on that one. Audi's not going to buy them out anytime soon.
Oh, well, yeah. That's the only way they could get out of it, if they sell their team to someone else.
Yeah, but who's going to throw around that kind of money? Because I remember when they put like a 300, I think it was like a £300 million price tag on Toro Rosso, the junior team. Like, like how much is the main team going to be worth? Like $500-600 million? Like, who's going to throw that kind of money at it? Like, there's not enough rich idiots in the world for that to happen. Because if you're that rich, you're probably not a fool. So, yeah. You know, I don't see like it would be nice for Red Bull to get back up there, because you know they are a staple team, they are a likable team with Daniel Ricciardo and Daniil Kvyat, who had a fantastic second season in Formula 1, which not many people talked about this year was Kvyat, how great he was this year. But they have a very likable team, and I've always rooted for them because of, well, obvious reasons. And you know, I'd like to see them do well, and I think it's good for the sport that they're there, because I think Red Bull like is more important to F1 than F1 is to Red Bull, because they are such a marketing juggernaut now, Red Bull, that I don't think they really need to be there per se. But when it comes to Red Bull, I wouldn't worry about their future. They're going to be here for at least another 4 years unless they sell up, which I don't think anyone is going to do at the price points they're projecting. That's just my opinion. Casper asking on Twitter, sorry for pronouncing your name wrong, by the way, it's a complicated one. Hungarian names, what can you do? Which F1 era or single season was, in your opinion, closest to perfection / perfect balance in the sport? Now, this is something I think that was following on from something I tweeted about, talking about the balance required, I think, between technology and entertainment in Formula 1 to try and please everybody. Now, has there been an era out there that's come close to that, or has there been any kind of era of bliss? King, you're the F1 historian out of the three of us. Any ideas?
it's hard. I'd have to say it depends on what you mean by, like, balance. Like, if you count, like, just parity between teams, I'd have to say the early to mid-70s. Right. If you have to say between parity between teams, also including manufacturers, I'd have to say the early 60s.
That's not a good sign.
Yeah.
If we're talking about an era of F1 that was like 40 to 50 years ago, because like I've been watching F1 since roughly 1999, and as far as I can remember, there was always some contentious issue in Formula 1, whether it be engines, whether it be tires, whether it be suppliers, whether it be politics on any level. You know, obviously now in the modern era with Pirelli and the V8 sounds and things like that, and we've become a bit more of a bitchy society when it comes to what we want out of F1 because of social media and whatnot.
And everyone can voice their opinions.
Exactly. We know the open forum that is the internet now, something we just didn't have 15 years ago when I first started watching. So I can't think of an era of any kind of balance like that. I mean, like I said, King knows better. I'll be the first person to admit King knows more about this shit than I do. But from my experience, there's always been some contentious issue, and even more so now in the middle of a brand new hybrid era that still has some kinks to iron out, that's still ludicrously expensive and something that's going to ostracize the smaller teams to a degree because of how expensive they are. And, you know, it's an issue, but then again, given that these engines cost millions and millions to develop, you know, these manufacturers have got every right to try and get some of their money back on it. So it's a pain in the butthole because there's no easy answer.
Yeah, but see, There's two things to take out of this. Number one, I feel like Formula One has always tended towards more of a purity in racing because it is the top of the ladder. So technological advancement has always, taken precedent for the most part, I feel like. For the most part, it has been an arms race. King,
yeah.
You sounded like you're going to disagree. Come forth, I'll bow to your knowledge.
It's a balance between both. It's always been a balance between both.
Agreed.
Because when Formula One was first founded, they made the rules to specifically not allow German cars.
Yeah. See where we're getting at here?
Yes. See, this is the thing here. My second point is that over in the World Endurance Championship, I know it's a Formula One discussion. Tumblr. We're going to bring in the World Endurance Championship. I'm sorry. Tumblr is okay to chill out here for a bit. It's okay. It's a safe space.
Sure.
But over there, you have races that go 6 hours regularly and go 24 hours, obviously, Le Mans 24 hours. And those races are still very, very fascinating and dramatic and are pretty much the results in the balance for a long time over those 6 hours and 24 hours. So, and yet that series is held up as also the pinnacle of technological advancement. So have they found a way of having their cake and eating it? I mean, obviously, they can get away with having less manufacturers at the top of the sport and spending more money because even if you only have two LMP1 teams, that's four cars in LMP1, you're still going to have 10 odd cars in LMP2, 15 odd in GT, all of that. So that's okay. But at the same time, you know, Formula One is, it feels to me, especially now, fans are incredibly, incredibly against the idea of balancing the field. Success balanced, anything like that? No. But no, I mean, that is just nothing like that. And yet, I mean, at the same time, they don't like dominance. Where's the middle ground?
There isn't one.
Hard exactly. Because, like, the WEC is completely balanced because of the regulations that they have fuel flow limits based on what
power. Yeah, guess what? They have similar fuel flow limits to F1.
Yeah, and to people who say that's not pure, the original Grand Prix regulations in 1906 had a fuel flow limit.
There you go. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's an impossible question to really answer because I said it before on Twitter, like, if you go too far one way, you'll have a manufacturer-dominated sport and people don't want that. But at the same time, if you go too far the other end, you're going to have basically a glorified WWE-style scripted product that's deliberately designed to be entertaining and not necessarily one that's about technology and innovation, which is what the series has obviously had over the last 60
years. And obviously, drivers competing at the very top of their game.
Exactly, so you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't have it either way or the other either. Like, for it to be a healthy, functional sport, you've got to get the balance right. Like any diet, for example, or anything along those lines. So for me, perfection will never happen because there's just too many different individual elements to make up this sport. But it's nice to think about the old times every once in a while, right?
And nostalgia. On that,
nostalgia, yeah. And speaking of which, Robot Wars is coming back.
Yes! The hype levels are unreal.
So hype about that. Oh, God. Like, BBC Two, please don't mess that up, for the love
Excuse
of God.
Excuse me while
please.
I go and mark out.
Yeah.
And also, if you want younger replacements for Craig Charles and Jonathan Pearce, if they don't fancy coming back to do it...
Hey.
And hey, Ryan, have you got a blonde wig somewhere? I'm sure they won't.
No,
yeah,
I'm
Philippa
not.
Forest is off doing gardening now.
Look, kids, Snoop Dogg is here. Nah. No, but yeah, we're obviously very excited about that too. We promised we'd get that in at some point during the podcast. So yeah, Robot Wars back, hype. But that's going to just about do it for this episode of the Motorsport 101 podcast. Obviously, you can find us at harrison101.com and on iTunes. We're going to find a way to get ourselves on Stitcher very soon. I know people have asked me about that, and that's something I'm going to prioritize very, very soon. And obviously, you'll be catching some of the highlights on YouTube as well, obviously, if you haven't already. But then again, why would you do that if you listen to this already? So you can find me at harrison101hd on Twitter. You can find Adam at AJ_BomberSports. He changes his username around because he's an idiot like that.
Just to confuse you.
just to confuse us all. And you can find Ryan King at Ryan Eric King. That's Eric with a K, A-R-I-K, Ryan Eric King. You can find him on Twitter. And then his website, the formuletta.com. He's changed it around because he didn't want to be a Formula E site anymore. So until next time, thank you very much for listening. I've been Andre Harrison. He's been Adam Johnson and Ryan King. And until next time, thank you very much for listening. I'll catch you guys next time. Sayonara.
Woo-hoo! Dean Agassi!
Ben's gonna done it, mate.
Thanks enough for you.
You are the world champion!